Coming up, Francis Fisher joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. We talk about movies here.
Yep.
Hello, Tamara Burke, my lovely
co-host. You. How are you this fine day?
It's not a great day. You know, sometimes the personal events, even though I don't watch the news anymore, seep out. All the talk with the budget cutting and we're going to be now, you know, which is the day has finally arrived. Hopefully the private sector is used to this. But, you know, there's going to be major. They'll probably put the NEA finally. Curse those damn artists. They are the bane of everybody's existence.
They are. That's us. They're dying.
Yeah, so there'll be lots of cutting of the arts. You know, to me, again, a society without art in it is ugly and sad. Art brings us together.
Yes.
I write in my book, when I was a kid, I was part of a NEA granted theater group called the Hartford Stage Company Youth Theater. We were sponsored by United Technologies, which was a Hartford based technological company. My father was involved in Connecticut Commission of the Arts. Arts funding was my whole life,
and
I am certainly a benefactor of that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I used to do the live living room show with Matt Sorum, you know, it was all about arts funding, called Adopt the Arts, and Jane Lynch is involved in that, some other great people, just about how important it is to have an outlet of art, just to express yourself. And you know, not everything is getting it out on the basketball team
exactly.
or the football. You know, I mean, I know sometimes sitting and drawing makes me feel better. And it's a way of expressing ourselves. And it's a sad day. It hurts. It's painful.
It is. I grew up in public school, but I was in one of the programs that gave that had federal funding, that had specific money allocated towards kind of personal enhancement. Of life. So I learned how to weave, and I learned how to collect eggs from chickens, and I mean all sorts of things that I did. I made a movie, a stop action claymation movie, all sorts of things, and that was public school, publicly funded.
Right.
I have a sister who's an art teacher. I have a mother who probably would have been an art teacher if she'd gone into teaching. The arts have been incredibly instrumental in my life, and I think they're. Mm-hmm. I think, like you say, I mean, it creates people with larger life experiences. It helps you cope with things. It helps
yes.
you understand things.
I think, to me, another thing that it does is it gives you courage. You know, somebody like Trump, who's so against, the musical Hamilton, it's because it is, gives people courage that there's a bigger life out there. And also it joins us together.
Absolutely.
You know, culture without art is very, very dark indeed. And it's a very sad day. More and more, I think that this is going to affect, people in a very negative way, a society that does not celebrate art and artists.
And I also think it's kind of it's a short term, cutting the arts is a short term answer to, a problem that's going to be created without the arts that will last a very long time. I mean, there are long-term repercussions to cutting the arts.
Well, I interviewed for Trailblazing Women. I interviewed Jane Alexander, who was part of a major debate of the NEA when Newt Gingrich tried to put the NEA out of business.
Right.
And she said a lot of what happened then was that the private sector got involved, but the federal government funds barely anything of the NEA. So it's not really the money. It's a statement. It's a statement that this regime wants to make, that we don't want individuality. We don't want art. We don't want, we want
creativity, expression.
Yeah, we want nameless, faceless minions to be worker bees. That's what it says to me.
Wow, yeah.
And, you know, because art is about expressing yourself and, again, coming together and sharing things that are beautiful and...
or provocative or, There are lots of...
To me, again, it's trying to create fear in people. And, again, it's the type of thing that it hopefully the result is that it creates more activists. You know, we're going to be talking to great actress Frances Fisher, who's really become very, very outspoken and somewhat of an activist. And... you know, it's a great subject to speak out on, but you know, how many, we're going to have more bombs, more of a war society, more of a Roman society versus a Greek artistic society, and it dark days for us.
Indeed. Let's bring in Frances.
Yes. Let's bring in the great Frances Fisher. She is, of course, you know her from her numerous roles in films like the Academy Award winning Titanic and also Unforgiven, House of Sand and Fog, The Lincoln Lawyer on television. She's been on Grey's Anatomy, The Shield, 2 and a Half Men, Private Practice, Sons of Anarchy, Torchwood, CSI Crime Investigation. She was last year in Resurrection, but she's also appeared on stage. She's also my neighbor.
Yay!
Come sit with us and talk. And she's also becoming a very outspoken activist. Ladies and gentlemen, there she is, the gorgeous Frances Fisher.
Yay!
Hi, Frances.
Oh, hey.
Do you know that when I always say, whenever I see you at an audition, I just go, well, it's over.
I think the same thing about you, and neither of us get the job.
No, it doesn't happen that way. I always say, hire Frances Fisher. It's just, she'll be more fun, and she'll get the, you get so many great parts unrolled. And my mother at least still likes you. So some actresses that I, like if I'm going in, she goes, that hog, she's working again. You know. But my mom likes you, so that's vote of faith.
Thank you, Mama.
Anyway, well, so great to have you
here.
Yeah,
you know, when you're talking about the NEA, was a quote that I put up on my Facebook. I can't remember. All I remember is that Winston Churchill is saying, you know, should we go into this war? It's like, well, what are we fighting for? It was about the arts.
Yeah.
We're fighting for the arts.
Yes.
This is what we go to war for. It's not to kill people.
Right.
We have to fight. It's so upsetting. I mean, the NEA budget is so minuscule as it is.
And yes, that's
exactly
what
you're saying. It's a big fuck you
to
people. And I just always wonder, when these guys go home and sit on their couch, what do? They turn on the television, and they're watching us.
Trump's favorite movie is Goodfellas.
Of course it
is. You know, by that anti-artist, Martin Scorsese.
Right.
Yeah.
it's to me, again, it's a larger argument, but the arts, you know, was so much for me about coping when I was younger, having the movies and finding people. When I moved to New York City and I found other actors and I got out of that very, you know, conservative, claustrophobic East Coast environment, I felt free and courageous. You know, being an artist is very... You know, is a very courageous thing to do, and seeing a great play, seeing an actor in a great play is very inspiring.
As children, we have imaginations, and we have to be taught how to use it. And, you know, it's been proven that if children in school have the arts and have physical education, which they're cutting back on now, too, recess, that they don't do as well in the STEM things, you know, science and math and all that stuff.
So
you need to express and shift, you know, work on the other side of the brain.
Yes. So we're going to get into your activism, but I just, so we're not all down. we're going to be huddled in a cave, like those people. We're going back in time, drawing little pictures on a cave.
We'll be telling stories around the fire.
Yes, we will.
And drawing on the cave walls.
They won't get us. what was the first movie you saw, and who took you to see it?
Oh, my mother. I grew up overseas, so I didn't watch television until we moved to Iowa when I was 10 years old. So going to the movies overseas was a big deal. She used to let me wear one of her bracelets. I'd carry a little purse, and we would go to the movies as if it were going to church. That's that's what she instilled in me. And the first movie I saw was Spartacus.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that really made an impression. And the second movie, I remember we were in Paris at the time, and we went to the Arc de Triomphe, and then we went to see West Side Story.
Oh, wow.
And I think back, you know, in the generation that we come from, we only saw movies on a big screen, and we only saw a little television when we could. There weren't tapes and things like that. And I realized that the impressions that the movies I saw really affected me because it was one time and it was big. I wonder about the kids today, because I know my daughter saw Snow White 20 times, you know, and put the tape in.
Right.
Like, how is that repetitive viewing on a small screen affecting the brains of the kids today as opposed to what we...
Right. Well, seeing it in a movie theater, to me, was a sensory... That's why I always ask, who took you to see it? Because my sensory experience was not only the movie, but it was my grandmother, it was my grandfather, it was going to Radio City, it was in a drive-in, it was... Like you said, you had to drive to get there. It was a really, really big deal.
It's a shared experience.
Yeah.
You know, I just went to Richard Schickel's memorial the other day, and he has a beautiful quote in at the end of one of his books. He wrote 37 of them. And he talks about what going to the movies is. It's where you go in there to escape the temporary pain of your life and to share an experience with strangers. And, you know, hopefully come out friends. Well, that's what happens in the theater, right? I mean, that's why I love going to the theater and participating in, on stage. But, you know, you go in as strangers and you share a common experience and you turn to your neighbor and you laugh and you, you know, and then you come out and you know each other. It's a community experience and we need that today.
Yes.
You know, we need to know we have community.
I agree. Now, you move. I was reading that you moved about 9 or 10 times when you were a kid. That must have been very
well. That's all I knew. That's all I knew. That's how I grew up. My father was a construction supervisor. He built oil refineries and steel mills all over the world, and he would take us with him. My mother was very adventurous, and I had an older sister and a younger brother. And before I was born, he built the first oil refineries in Iran. And he would tell us stories about Iran, you know, how he's just in barracks alone and all they could do is play bridge because there was nowhere to go because they were in the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
Yeah, so we, you know, wherever his job, Foster Wheeler, took him, he'd gather the family around and like, okay, well, we have a chance to go to Turkey. I wouldn't recommend it, but if you want to go, and all the kids were like, we want to go, we want to go.
That's amazing.
And Turkey was amazing because we lived on in Ereğli, which was on the south side of the Black Sea, and the water was crystal clear. And they forgot to hire teachers for all the kids in the camp. So we did correspondence courses. Somebody's wife came in and taught us half a day in the church. There were about 6 kids in 7th and 8th grade. I was in 7th grade at the time. I learned nothing. But we went to school for half a day, and the rest of the day we would go out and rent horses from the local farmers, and we would ride on the beach and sit on the beach and swim in the ocean. It was an amazing,
wow, that sounds wonderful,
idyllic experience.
And so were you seeing movies then, or like
there was a mess hall. There was a mess hall up at the top of the hill where all the bachelors had their barracks, and that's when I first knew. I was only 12, for God's sake, but you know, those bachelors were pretty hot.
Well, they had those uniforms on, right?
Well, they didn't wear uniforms.
Oh, they didn't have uniforms?
I think every Friday they would have a movie. You know, everybody would go to the mess hall and eat dinner, and then all the kids would line up in the front, and they would put the screen down, and we'd watch some movie or something.
That's great. And so then how soon after that did you get the acting bug early on?
I wrote a play. I wrote a Christmas play there in Iraeli for everybody. And, of course, made myself the lead. It was about Christmas. It was about elves and stuff, and I was Jinx the elf. But I remember looking back now, I had it all set up, but I forgot to light it, so it was really dark. There was no light on us. It's like, okay, I'm a director
Expressionist.
And writer, yeah.
Film noir Christmas.
When did I get into it? I guess I did a couple plays in high school, but that really wasn't it. After I graduated high school in Texas, somebody dared me to audition for a community theater thing. And I got involved with that. It was kind of like a song and dance, you know, one of those every 3 years the community gets together and sings and dances and for the rest of the people who are too scared to get up on stage. And then Bobby Papania asked me to audition for Summer and Smoke to play the role of Nellie, the young, the ingenue. So I, okay. So I went down to the theater. It was like a real theater. And by the time I got home, I had the job, and I was really excited. And that started me on my path, because even though I was working as a secretary for Firestone there, because I was 18 years old, had to have a job. My day started when the whistle blew at 4 o'clock. I would change out of my dress, and I would go down to the theater and spend my whole evening there till like 11 o'clock. And to cut my teeth on Tennessee Williams, I mean, that was really the first play that I absorbed.
Well, and I'm always fascinated too by, as much as, you know, Christopher Guest kind of makes fun of community theater, you know, I've been to some very touching community theater productions that, you know, maybe people aren't the best actors, but they're really well-meaning and really delving into the work. And it's all we have these days, you know?
Yeah.
If somebody can't afford to go to New York City, you know?
Yeah.
Ability to see a play.
Yeah. And if I hadn't gone that route, I probably would have grandkids by now living in Orange, Texas. Divorced, I'm sure.
So you're doing the theater, and then did you go to New York?
After that, I did A Man for All Seasons, another great play by Robert Bolt. And it was like, oh, this, you talk about the NEA. I mean, you know, to be exposed to theater and art and dance and music, it's so important for a young person. You know, you don't have to go in and become an accountant or, you know, try to make money, you know. I did that. And then I did MAME, and I played Agnes Gooch.
Oh, Agnes Gooch.
And I was the costume director, too. So I designed all the costumes, because it's community theater. You know, we do everything. And during one of those plays, I can't remember when, there was no place to go after the theater, so we would go to somebody's house and have food and drink. And there was a New York actor who had come to Orange, Texas. Now, Orange, Texas is a little bitty town on the border of Texas and Louisiana. And he sat me down and he says, you know, Frances, you could be a professional. You've got talent. And I was like, really? Nobody ever told me that. My mother had since died. She died when I was 15. My father was working all the time. He wasn't, you know, paying attention to what was going to go next. He did want me to go to college. But he said, you could be a professional. It's like, wow, how do I do that? How do I get out of this little bitty town? And he said, I can give you a letter of recommendation to the Barter Theater in Virginia. And that's where you can learn everything about stagecraft. You won't get on stage because they hire professionals from New York.
Right.
But you will learn everything about how to put a production together. And so I decided to go. I divorced my husband. And I got on a Greyhound bus on a rainy night with my little suitcase. And took that trip.
Wow, that's amazing.
That
sounds like
Virginia.
A Betty Davis movie.
Yeah.
You got your suitcase and left.
Yeah, I should probably write that and give it to my daughter to play, because she's about that age, you know, that she could play that part.
Very much so. I didn't even know you were, you got married very young.
Yeah, it was basically, now I look back and it was like to get out of the house, you know.
Yeah.
It was like I didn't want to go to college. I had such a screwed up education because of being the new kid every year.
Right.
Like when we moved from, I learned to read and write French before English because that was where we were in France in the first grade. There was no American school. So I was stuck in a French school. It was like, what are they saying to me? And I learned to read and write. And then we moved directly to Rio de Janeiro, and they'd screwed up my records, and they put me in third grade instead of second. And the only reason they fixed it is because I didn't know how to spell Thanksgiving and pilgrim. So I knew it was November that we moved there. But it was that kind of thing. And, school, I did not like sitting in a class and having to recite
answers. So then you're in Virginia doing learning. I mean, so this is sort of like your college of learning all about
acting, theater. We built sets. We struck sets. I built costumes. Mm-hmm. I assisted the director. I would cue actors, everything to do with theater. And, you learn how to put a production together, and it gave me a great respect for crew that I think I carry to this day. You know, it's not just the people on the stage that are important. It's the whole group. And I love that camaraderie, the family, as we call it, right?
I do, too. Yeah. I love every, just walking on a stage. I get, a big thrill. Just the process. I've always loved the process of it.
Yeah.
And so then what year did you go to New York?
I was there for a season, and the way I got to New York, because after the plays, there was no place to go there either, so everybody would just go back to the big dorm that everybody lived in, and we would sit around and talk, and I would talk to the actors who had come down from New York and the directors who came down, and I said, well, eventually you're going to go to New York City. And it's like, yeah, I know. I don't know how. One of the actresses, Ann Buckles, I was assigned to cueing her, and she asked me what I was going to do after this season, and I said, well, I just want to get to New York. She said, well, I have a 3-year-old daughter. You could come up and be a nanny, and you could live in the maid's room. I live on Park Avenue, and it's small, but it's like, so I went, okay.
Yeah.
So I became a nanny for the first few months that I was in New York and lived in the maid's room that was really small. But I took Yvonne to school, and then I found my way to acting classes. I found the HB Studios. And so I enrolled there with a
Did you study with Uta Hagen?
No, but I would peek in every once in a while. She was always full up, and I was too shy to, I was so young. I was probably 20 at that point. And but I remember Austin Pendleton. He doesn't remember me. But I started making my way.
Into that, and then I'm fascinated. You also I got sort of your real start doing soap operas, and when I was in acting school, all my friends would get these little like 5 lines and on a soap opera, and I could never. I would always bomb out. Like I used to think, well, there's no chance for me. I can't even get on a soap opera, but all my friends, Alice and Janney, they all got these little parts on soaps,
76. I guess I went up there in 73. And then I started doing theater because, read backstage, go audition. And I was doing lots and lots of theater, experimental theater, St. Clement's and, church basements and stuff like that. And then it's such a funny journey. It really is. My boyfriend and I at the time had been living in a rooming house on 46th Street, which is Restaurant Row, but we were at the other end of Restaurant Row with a bunch of dirty old men, not really dirty, but smelly, and we would share the bathroom with them, and he was a struggling photographer, I'm a struggling actress, and he had, sold something, and we were able to start renting the entire first floor, and so we got to enclose our bathroom, and we were, living there, and I had been going out and putting my resume out. I didn't know anything. I didn't know I had to have an agent. Nobody taught me anything. That's the one thing that I was really, really naive. I should have gone to an acting school or something or a how-to the way they have them now.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, I used to walk into advertising agencies and give them my resume and go, I'd like to do a commercial. And they look at me and they go, you can't do that here.
I would do stuff like that too.
But let me tell you what happened. On Christmas Eve, I got a phone call. And it was from somebody who was doing a commercial called a buyout, which means only cash, no residuals.
Right.
The day after Christmas, we found your resume. We like your face. Would you come and do this commercial? You'll get $300. That's it. Mm-hmm. The day after Christmas, I'm like, $300? Yes, of course. So I show up for this little commercial, and I'm walking in and out of an elevator, but the elevator operator was a guy named Richie Allen, who was one of the hottest commercial guys in the business at that time. Mm-hmm. And he felt so sorry for me because he knew I was like, what's going on? He took me around and he started showing me how to crash commercial auditions. He introduced me to his agents because in New York, as you know, you can have more than one agent.
Right.
It's fucked up out here in LA. You know, you're supposed to be with one.
Right.
You could freelance and, you know, have a... because our agents have a lot more than one actor.
Yeah.
Anyway, that got me to agencies, mm-hmm. and I would go in and give them my resume, and they would sometimes send me out for a commercial audition. And one of them said, you've got an audition for The Edge of Night.
Wow.
It's like, it's a soap opera. I was like, I don't want to do soap operas. I want to be a theater actress. And then somebody said, well, you can make money. You can do that during the day and do the theater at night. It's like, oh, okay. So I went in, and, you know, it's before tape, and the other actor was actually in the room, who played my father, Louis mm-hmm. Turenne. And the minute I walked in the room, full of, you know, people, I went, Daddy! And he went, Deborah! And we hugged. We did the scene. It was one of those magical moments that just, you know, because sometimes when you go into the door, it can feel really awful.
Oh, yes. Right?
So by the time I got home, the call was on my answering machine. You got the job.
Oh, I love it.
2-year contract.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
And so then what happened to the boyfriend? Did he?
We stuck around. We were together for 6 years. 2 years, I said, we made a deal. 2 years, I'll do this. You get your camera stuff together, and then you'll start making money. I'll go back to the theater and do more of that. And then, as life would have it, as a 24-year-old and then a 25-year-old making all that money, because it was a lot of money, $425 a day, 2 days a week.
That's pretty good.
It was almost, yeah, that was almost a guarantee of, you know, $1,000 a week.
Right.
That was big. Back then, in the 70s.
Yeah, you bet.
It didn't work out. I had to extend my contract for another 2 years because he hadn't kept his end of the bargain.
Oh.
And I was, you know, liking the money, putting it away. I was saving it. I would always save 30% of whatever I made, put it into savings, which is something that everybody out there should be doing. Save your money.
were you getting recognized? I mean...
No.
Really?
No.
Oh, God. No. We always... I mean, I lived near where they shot one of the soap operas on Columbus, and we could always... You know, see them walking in the street.
Yeah.
They're so-and-so.
After I was done with it, you know, they, you know, people, oh, Deborah Saxon, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then you moved, I want to get to, of course, some of your great film roles. Now, did you do the Lucille Ball movie before you did the Henry Jaglom film? Can She Bake a Cherry Pie?
Oh, no, that was my very first film ever that I did with him. I know. Improvised.
Yeah, very improvised. Of all the Henry Jaglom films, that's actually my favorite one.
Uh-huh.
And I like Karen Black quite a bit. She was sweet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very sweet lady.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that was, I think that was like 86. I did that, and I did Norman Mailer's movie, Tough Guys Don't Dance, the same year. So that was after the soap opera. That was in the 80s. And, we were sitting around at Cafe Central. Remember Cafe Central?
Yeah, that's sort of just ending as I get to New York around, like, 82.
Oh, okay.
So it's just, but it's the, I'm... it's the tail end.
Tail end of it.
Of that.
Yeah.
But still great. And then it veers into Columbus.
Columbus, yeah.
Everything.
Well, Cafe Central, for those of you who don't know, was a great watering spot, if you will, for people in theater and film and television. I mean, you know, Bruce Willis was the bartender.
Yeah.
You know? Right. And... one of our best casting directors.
Did you know Chris Noth? Because he talks a lot about... Yeah, he was at the...
We were all there. So one evening, you know, Henry... I happened to be sitting at Henry's table, and he was going, oh, I'm starting this film, and I don't have a production manager. I went, oh, I'll do it. You know how to production manage? I went, yeah. And all I had done was put together a few of my boyfriend's slides into a, you know, like a movie, you know?
Yeah.
But I did, and he said, well, there's also this part. It was a like, tiny little part, but it was literally the very first time I had ever, you know, done a film and completely improvised, mm-hmm. as we know. Yeah, and then I got some... Oh, by that time, I was a member of the Actors Studio.
So
I had auditioned.
You had to audition?
And gone in. Oh, yeah, you all have to audition.
Yeah.
And I was a member there, and then one day... They had gotten a call from Norman Mailer, and they wanted to find someone who could be believable as an ex-porn star who was now a realtor mm-hmm. in Santa Barbara. And they went, Frances Fisher.
Of course.
You got to meet her.
That's funny.
She's the gal.
Yeah, so I actually auditioned for Norman in downstairs at the Actor's Studio.
Were you scared?
No.
I would be scared.
No.
Norman Mailer.
I mean, no, I was excited.
Yeah.
I was excited, you know.
And that's why I didn't get so many parts. I was always like, I can't believe it. I would always want to talk about their movies. And then I'd be like, yeah, I'd have to audition.
Yeah.
Not
some,
him.
Some,
writer, but.
Sometimes you're scared. You know who I was intimidated by, only because of my adoration, was Robert De Niro. I auditioned for him in some hotel room for something. And I just knew I wasn't going to do it because I was dealing with props too much instead of just looking at him. And
it's so interesting. I wrote a whole chapter working with him is because I had this experience of people being so unnerved by him. I watched people just have meltdowns.
Yeah.
And so I knew I would have to do I write all about it because I said emotional preparation was not my strong suit, but I was going to have to do preparations and literally remove him from the equation of acting with him, or otherwise I would not be able to do the scene.
Right.
Which sometimes I feel that way because if I see people in movies, it's tough. All I do is see their films. You know, it's hard to imagine you're in the scene with them.
Yeah.
But that's funny. Yeah. And so you auditioned for him, and did he? Was he?
He was
notoriously uncommunicative. And nice.
And I can't remember. I can't remember the name of the movie, but Kathy Baker got it, I think. But, mm-hmm. But I
you go to a hotel room and you're sitting in the lobby.
Oh, I know.
Was it one of those?
So intimidating. Yeah, one of those big hotel rooms and
it's the worst.
Waiting and there's like 10 people who look just like
you. I know. I would always think that people were thinking I was a prostitute too.
Oh, sure, because you're all dressed up.
Everyone else is, everyone else is here for acting, but she's just a prostitute. You know? That's because I have low self-esteem. But, yeah. And sometimes when you're down there, like 2 hours, it's like a meltdown for me. You see somebody come down, and you go, oh, well, it's hopeless.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's going to get it.
You see, like, super famous people, and so you go, oh, they're going to get it, you know.
I know. It's the auditioning is still the oddest thing to me in the world.
Yeah.
Very unreal way to do things.
I like it because I can try on the shoes of the character and then also check them out because... You know, we would audition for theater back then.
Right.
And, you know, you'd meet the people in the room, and I would always come in and say, you know, I've read the script, I've mm-hmm. done some work on it, but this is like my first rehearsal.
Yeah.
And please give me notes. And that's what's so great about having the director in the room. Now, there are so many times that you audition for, a camera, and it's like there's no interaction. And
I like when they say, put yourself on tape.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, go through your phone. Yeah. And you're like, this is a major film. What am I doing?
Put yourself on tape. Well, you can go to those places, right, where they have good lighting. And actually, it's actually better than doing it in the office where you've got terrible overhead light. And some of you
the best light in my house is in where the washer and dryer is. serious. So it seems so surreal to me that I'm dressed like a lawyer and that I set up
in your laundry room
on my washing machine.
Oh, fantastic.
And I'm telling you, he's guilty. You know, and I'm like, this is ridiculous.
You need to create flats behind you.
Exactly.
Office flat.
Or just get better lighting in that house.
Did you have, I've told this ad nauseum, but my Alan Parker story where I thought I was doing really well and he stopped my audition and said, who sent you here?
Oh, no.
I was devastated because I was such a big fan of his. But did you ever have any, like, bomb out auditions where you just, like, to me, it always would happen when I thought I was doing really well. That's what's so... I'm like, oh, my God, I'm nailing it. Nailing it. I'm on the set. We're going to be hanging out at the bar. And they're like, thank you, Eliana. Leave. Leave. I was like, I thought I was doing good. But do you...
That's such a... It's hard to know, isn't it? Because sometimes... I know one time I went in and did what I thought was a great job. They laughed, they cried, literally, and somebody hugged me at the end. Thank you so much for coming in. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
I didn't get it. I came to my acting class because at that point I was studying with Sandra C. Catt.
Oh, yes.
And I told her and the group, I said, I don't understand why. I mean, I got a hug. Mm-hmm. Why do they hug you? It's like, unless they knew I wasn't going to get it, they tried to make me feel better. And she gave me a piece of advice that I carry with me. She said, you know, we're on a spiritual journey on this planet. And maybe you did so well in the audition that your soul didn't need to go through the actual exercise of making the film. And at that point, I was like, okay.
All right, I'll buy
now,
that.
Now, I was like, I'll buy that. Please, just tell me anything to get me through this pain. Yeah.
So then you did, then you worked with Paul Schrader.
Mm-hmm.
And
Patty Hearst.
And Patty Hearst.
Yeah, that was wild. They thought it was a good idea for us to go up to San Francisco, the SLA. I was part of the SLA.
Yeah.
And so we all went up to San Francisco, and they rented one of those apartments, put stuff in the window, hung stuff in the window, and made it look like a safe house. And they kept us in there for 2 weeks. They would only let us out to, like, go to the gym, maybe. And then we had to cook our own food. I mean, they had a list of, like, who was going to... And we put Natasha in the closet one time just because we wanted to get into it. We all slept on the floor in sleeping bags. It was crazy.
Yeah.
Who was on? Natasha Richardson, of course. Bless her heart.
Yeah.
Ving Rhames. Mm-hmm. Dana Delaney. Who else? Bill Forsyth. I think they're all the ones who are still in the biz. But it was a, you know.
That was
and
intense.
We would sit and watch. Yeah, it was intense. And we would watch, you know, Malcolm X movies and documentaries and all that about the Weather Underground and get into our little, you know.
See, I don't think actors in those days, you know, you'd be really into doing some you know, because you were a very serious actor.
Oh, yeah. But, it was great. I loved it.
But I have a feeling that these days, you know, you have 2 days to rehearse and then you're shooting.
Well,
I miss,
you know,
all that.
The whole business has changed in so many ways. And the one thing that's really sad about it is that when you got hired for a job, a film, you were there the whole time.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
days
run of the picture.
On hold,
run of the picture.
So you could get to know your fellow castmates. You could work together on stuff. Now they have it so scheduled that you just job in, you do your costume fitting, you do your little piece of the scene, and then you're out. And it's like you don't know anybody else. It's so...
No. I always ask to go to the set like a day, and people go, "Why? We can't pay you." I'm like, no, I don't want to be paid. I just want to hang out and be a part of the film.
Yeah, and do you guys think that affects the final product?
Totally,
yeah.
Totally. Because we're all bringing our energy together, and we're part of the fabric of it all.
Yeah.
And I want to know who the DP is and meet the costume people before I have to be in a fitting and just get the tone. Get the feel of it.
Yeah.
See how they're working, you know?
Also, it's a sense of pride. I know that the first movie that where I was the run of the picture was Goodfellas. And, I mean, I think I was only in three scenes or four scenes or something. But, again, it was a run of the picture. And so you'd go in the morning, there was this huge hall, and we'd all get made up, and then, you know, sometimes you wouldn't even be in this shot. You'd just be, like, at a table if it was a wedding or something.
Right.
But we added to the atmosphere, and we were thrilled to be there, and so that by the time your scene was up, you were completely in the mood.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
You knew exactly what was required of you.
Yeah, and then you get to watch all the other great actors working. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It was amazing. Yeah. So then after that, so then you get cast in, and then where's Lucy fit in? Where's your Lucy film? Because that's when I first saw you.
Oh, well, that was an interesting thing. The reason, how Lucy came about was that same acting class with Sandra Seacat.
Mm-hmm.
One of the participants was Desmond Child, who's a fantastic music producer. Mm-hmm. He's worked with all the greats. And he was there learning about acting because he wants to know more. And I had brought in some headshots. Mm-hmm. when they were like the 36, you know, strips and all that. And I brought them in for everybody at the class to, you know, which one would be the best. And toward the end of the 36, I had thrown my hair up and played around a little bit. Mm. And he goes, you know, this shot right here, you look a lot like a young Lucille Ball. It's like, really? So one day I was walking past Sam French or something like that. I went in and I looked at a book about Lucy and I started learning about her life and how she came up and who she was. And I did notice a similarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got obsessed with reading about her and, you know, the first woman to, like, take the bull. I don't want to say take the bull by the horns because that's a stupid thing to do. To command her own path.
Yes, yeah, your first female studio head.
Yeah,
Desilu.
40 years old she did it back then. That would be like
first interracial 65. Marriage on television.
Yes, yes, and she fought for Desi.
Yeah, so.
So I thought someday I'm going to play that part. I just knew it in my bones. Like I knew I was going to get Edge of Night. Now I'm thinking now, it's like, I just said I wanted it and it happened. How come it hasn't happened since? My God, when do these moments?
I think that when you're young, you have such clarity about your goals, you know? That's what I feel like. And that once you're successful, it becomes, a little more scattered. That's just my own feeling.
Yeah.
But when you're younger, you're like, I am going to win an Oscar.
This is going to happen.
This is going to be my Oscar speech. And you have to learn, you have to find your way back, I think, to those goals.
To those goals and having, being one pointed.
Yeah, because the business, you know, you can become cynical or, you know, embittered in some ways. And, you know, it's hard. I find you always have to rediscover, you know, that sort of joy. But I was thinking as you were, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just thinking the Lucy. Yeah, I just finished this bit because in my mind I was like, I got to finish that. So I had moved out to Los Angeles. I moved out here in 88 because I had the opportunity to work with Robert Mitchum on a TV thing in LA, in New York. And we were sitting together and he goes, well, kid, it's just time to spread your wings. Go out to Los Angeles. That's where they make movies. Okay, Mr. Mitchum, I'll follow your advice. I've worked with some tough guys. I loved him so much. So I happened to be reading Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, and there was like a little thing that CBS was going to do the Lucy and Desi Before the Laughter, and I went, oh my gosh, this was 10 years later after I'd done those pictures. I thought, I am going to go back to that photographer, get myself all done up like Lucy, and I'm going to send that headshot in like that. And that's what I did. And I was the first one that they auditioned because they were so curious at who would do this because I looked enough like her.
Yeah.
Then, you know, and I ended up getting it. Yeah. I wish that the production had... Never mind.
I thought it was great. I loved it.
Well, they spent too much time doing a false, you know, talent search as opposed to working on true pre-production.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you can still play. You can play her as older.
Well, you know what Desmond wants to do. Should I say this? Okay. Desmond called me up a couple of years ago. He goes, Francis, we've got to do Lucy and Viv. Everybody's done Lucy and Desi.
Oh. Yeah.
I want to explore the relationship between Lucille Ball and Vivian Vance. So we've been doing research. I've been singing because he wants to make it a musical. And it's going to be those two.
Well, only you can play it, so I wouldn't worry about anyone taking your part. Okay, so I want to get to your work, of course, with Clint Eastwood. So this is 1989. You get cast in Pink Cadillac.
Yeah, well, it came out in 89, of course, so it was 88. Yeah, I went in to audition on tape for this little bitty part in Pink Cadillac, and then I got the part and went up to Reno, I think it was, to do, was I on the run of the show? I think they had run of the show back then too, but I met him. He always has pre-parties rather than rap parties because most people are gone by
that's
then.
Nice.
So he had an opening party, and it was like in this little, almost like a Motel 6 thing. We were all staying there, and I just walked over to him, and I thanked him for casting me. And he looked at me like, silly me. I didn't realize he looks at everybody that way, but I completely fell in love.
Were you, now, had you been a fan of Eastwood movies?
No, I didn't, you know.
His movies really changed.
Huh?
His move from his, you know, early Dirty Harry movies.
Yeah, I think I went to see one Dirty Harry movie with my husband in Texas, and I, you know, like, whatever. But, interestingly enough, when we came back from Turkey and, it was before we were in Turkey, 10 years old, my mom, we finally had a TV because we were living in Iowa, and she would let us watch 3 shows, not a lot. So I got to watch The Twilight Zone, I Love Lucy, and Rawhide, because she liked the older guy. Think about it. That's so, about the, what I was saying earlier about the impressions that things have on your mind if you're not so overwhelmed with a lot.
Yes.
Those 3 things kind of happened for
Absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. It's completely opening a door to your destiny.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then how, so you're doing, and then how long did after you did the film, because of course I was, you know, with a director and working with a director that you're also having a relationship with. Had you finished Pink Cadillac and then you're going into Unforgiven? Like, when does the relationship part begin?
Well, the, like right away, but it was like instant. And then we didn't do Unforgiven until, I'm like thinking back, like, when was I pregnant? That's when the Franny, 93, 92, 91. And I did Lucy in 90, and it came out in 91. And then we did, then we shot Unforgiven. And it was great working with him. Oh. I mean, it's a dream come true to work with your lover.
I auditioned for Unforgiven. I didn't get the part. I can't think of the girl's name with the big eyes. Blonde.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
She doesn't work much anymore. Mm. And then I did a movie with her afterwards.
Okay. Yeah. He asked me which part I wanted. And I just, he goes, I think Strawberry Alice because you're feisty. Mm-hmm. And I realized I probably made a mistake. I did go with that character because she was a fighter and a feminist, if you will, to round up the money to go after those guys who cut their friend. But I could have had a scene on camera forever with him, but I didn't want to have scars on my face. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was such a great script, though.
Yeah. Yeah. It didn't change a word. Yeah,
oh, my God. I remember every actress in Hollywood went to Warner Brothers to audition for that film, you know?
Yeah.
It was pretty. I was very nervous about that audition. I didn't get it. But as many of them, I didn't. So then you're in, and so did you relate, so working with someone, my relationship didn't change at all. I loved it because that was like my whole fantasy. We'll make movies together and be together and I'll be making movies, but did you have to keep it under wraps? Were you afraid like other actors would be jealous? Like, that's what I was always nervous of.
No. He's the best set in the world to work mm-hmm. on. I mean, there's no
That's what everybody
yelling.
Says. Yep.
It's like, you just look at it, it's like, this mm-hmm. is rolling. You know, there's never anybody yelling because everybody's so respectful because mm-hmm. he commands that just because they don't. They just have that respect for him. Because he had such a great group of people, mm-hmm. you know. Everybody was there for the work.
Doesn't he use the? He uses the same DP, Jack Green.
But then Jack graduated to making his own movies, so he moved up his gaffer to that position now, Tom. He's very loyal to his crew and to a lot of cast. You know, I worked with him again in another film called True Crime, and our daughter played his daughter in the movie. She was like 3 at the time or something. And you know, he may do another movie. You never know. The interesting thing was though there was this one scene that I have to tell you because it's like you were talking about the rape scene that you
Kid Fear.
That he was like so nervous that you were going to
As we were saying before camera, Mr. Scorsese, Marty, was more nervous than me. I was like, no, I'm here. I'm an actress. This is what I've been waiting my whole life to do. And he felt terrible, like filming me. So go ahead.
Well, the opening scene in Unforgiven for my character, Strawberry Alice, was that she's like, you know, fucking a guy in bed.
Yeah.
And so we set it up. And Jack Green was such a great light. I mean, he... Candlelight, you know, so
incredible.
Quick too. Such a quick lighter. There was never any waiting around, and so we did it once. I mean, and then it's like, then I hear Clint go, "Okay, that's enough of that. Moving on." And it's like, just one take. That's it. It's like, yeah, I got it. Okay, move on. You know,
that's amazing. Well, that's what everybody says. Is he has to do, you know, a lot of takes.
Sometimes shoots the rehearsal when you don't know it.
Yeah.
And
I'm slightly obsessed with Gene Hackman. I've never met him. That's my fantasy interview.
Yeah.
And what was it like working with him?
Oh, so, so easy.
So great.
So great. And, you know, when they would be relighting or something, he would sit in the corner and sketch everybody. And I've got one of his sketches that I framed.
Wow.
He did a sketch of me. And he was great. I remember the night he arrived, he and his lady arrived. And we all had dinner together, and he was supposed to work the next day. And he looks at Clint, he goes, I hear there might be rain. There's no way you're going to be doing that big scene if we have to move inside, right? No, absolutely not. We'll find something else to ease him in.
Right,
he had
right.
just arrived.
Yeah.
Sure enough, it rains cats and dogs the next day. And Clint goes, I'm going to have to get him. That's the only scene we've got. So Gene had to do that huge scene in the in the jail cell. I don't know if you remember it.
Yes.
But it's like, and he was spot on. I mean, you look at that work and you go, oh, my God.
Just. And then so wins the Academy Award.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, that must have just been the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Was that like a career?
For him? Are you talking about me?
You, yeah. Just to be even a part of a
part
film.
Of it. Well, to be part of a film that won, absolutely.
And that's such an American film. Made by an American filmmaker. I think that's why. It's a Western. It's just a beautiful film.
Yeah.
Beautiful film.
Yeah. Morgan Freeman. Yeah. Yeah, that was a great moment, and I was pregnant at the time, so I got to have Francesca.
Aww.
Not too long after that.
And so then you work on another film that is also an Academy Award winning movie, Titanic.
Oh yeah,
now that was a movie because I was friends with Danny Nucci. We were in Alive together, and he went off to do Titanic. They were in where were you?
It we were in Rosarito Beach, Mexico.
Yeah.
For 6 months.
Yeah, he was going out. He was going out of his mind. They were in water like every. Did it ever? Because that's my. I always said, oh God, how do you work in water? Like you're wet all the time.
Yeah. Fortunately, my character Ruth didn't have to get wet. You know, but a lot of the rest of the cast did, and they used the water from the ocean. It was cold.
Wow.
It was, so when Kate was doing like that, that wasn't acting. That was real cold water.
And so looking, because it's been so many years now, but I remember when they were making the movie, of course, it was Cameron's Folly, and it wasn't, I don't remember great press surrounding it, you know, because again, we're going back
20 years. Yeah. It was 20 years actually this year. Can't believe it.
You know, and then of course the movie comes out, it's unbelievable, successful, wins the Academy Award, and so it's like looking back on it still holds up. It's a great film.
I think
ensemble.
People were gunning for him a little bit. You know, he did give up his directing salary, but you know, he had his other salaries. But you know, he's such a visionary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a great respect for him because if you give 100%, you're in. You're mm-hmm. on the team. And I had a ball with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was great. I had a great audition. Can I talk about my audition?
Love it. Loved it.
Mally Finn, mm-hmm. God rest her soul, was one of the best casting directors I've ever worked with. So I got a call to come in and audition. And they gave me a couple of scenes, including the corset scene, mm-hmm. to do for her because Jim was shooting the modern day stuff up in mm-hmm. Nova Scotia. I did the scene and didn't hear anything. Like a month goes by. And then I'm asked to come back to meet Mr. Cameron. Do all those scenes plus the end of the movie. It's like, what do you mean the end of the movie? What? It's like a piece here, a piece there. And oh my God. So I did go down to Lightstorm with my little audition dress, you know, the turn of the century audition dress that we all keep in our closets, don't we?
Oh, yes.
With a little high collar and the hair up.
And the cop uniform. the detective blazer.
Yeah, the detective blazer and the hooker outfit.
Oh, I don't have, that's half my wardrobe.
So that's your whole wardrobe.
So I'm sitting in there, I'm by myself in this big waiting room, and this guy comes in with a lumberjack shirt and jeans, and he looks like a PA. He goes, Francis Fisher? Yes, come on back here. Long hall to this big conference room with a huge conference table, mm-hmm. and there's Mally and her assistant with the camera, and I look around, I go, where's Mr. Cameron? He goes, oh, that's me. The guy who came to get me was him. I'd never seen him or met him before. So at that moment, I went, oh. And we just looked at each other, and he goes, okay, you don't have to do all those other scenes again. I already saw them on tape. Let's focus on the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. And I went, I want to talk to you about that. We're going to have to shoot a moment and then stop, and I'm going to have to reset, mm-hmm. shoot another one, mm-hmm. because it's all broken up, because Ruth doesn't have a scene. She's right. like moments. Okay, great. So we do a couple of the little moments, like, you know, Rose, get in the boat. And I go, no, you know what? And he held the camera. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the assistant.
Yeah.
He held his camera. And I said, okay, you know, you're probably going to shoot it down, right? So can we get up on the table, and then I'll step down into the chair so you can see me reaching up going, Rose, get in the boat. He goes, okay. So we all got up on the table. I think I'm telling this is because it wasn't about me getting the job. I was so happy to be working
right.
on that. I knew this character. I mean, I knew what I wanted to do with this character. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel intimidated by him, because I loved the script so much, and I just felt like he got me. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we do the scene up on the table, and I step down. He goes, I should have brought a crane. I'm going to, you know, if I get sick, I know who's going to direct this scene. You know, it was like fun. We were having fun. And, and I ended up getting the job. Not right away, but that call was, I was so happy because it proved something to me. When you have the feeling and you have the knowing, you don't have to worry about anything. You just do your work. Because mm-hmm. I've gone in, as you know, on a lot of auditions where I just didn't feel right, and I knew I wasn't going to get it. I just had a feeling it wasn't mine, but I'd do it anyway because mm-hmm. it's a chance to work, isn't it? An audition. So, I don't know.
But being part of that, and you know, just I mean, you know, again, another American classic,
yeah,
film that must give you a lot of pride.
Well, you know, and also what the message was, the arrogance that we're seeing now in this century, the arrogance of you know, people thinking that they can conquer nature.
Right.
You know, climate change is real. And even if you deny and take money away from the EPA, it's going to come and bite you on the ass.
We only have a couple minutes left, so I just want to talk briefly about, you know, when we do the Trailblazing Women show, we focused on actresses that were trailblazers, speaking out, activists, you know, Jane Fonda, of course, so many others, and how important it is for public figures to speak out because they have the face. And you've just been, I see your posts on Facebook, and it's so thank you for that. It's amazing. Yeah. And what is it? Does it feel like a responsibility, or is it just something that's always been in you?
Well, I fought, marched against the Vietnam War. That's how old I am. And, you know, in Washington for ERA, that we still need to have, Planned Parenthood. And then I was a Bernie surrogate because I believed what he had to say. And that turned into Standing Rock. Shailene Woodley and Josh Fox were the ones who alerted me to what was going on there. And because it's not just about indigenous sovereignty, it's about the fracking, how bad it is, climate change, environmental issues. And, you know, we have a great responsibility to take care of the water and the earth and the air. Because the natives knew that. They've been around a long time. And I learned a lot from them. I went to Standing Rock for 2 weeks. Jane Fonda came during Thanksgiving. That's what they call it.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot for us to learn about.
Of course.
About what white people have done and how we've, you know, slaughtered and tried to slaughter their stories. And it was so beautiful to be at Standing Rock and hear some of their stories and see the young people carrying the message, because they started the whole thing. You know, it was them running from Standing Rock to Washington, D.C., to, like, say, this you can't do this to us anymore. We've been fucked for 500 years. Can't do it anymore. So the fight goes on.
And if people are fans of your films, like, what should they, how can they help? How can they be involved? Because that's what I mean, if they like your movies, I mean, don't you feel that you've given them films that they've enjoyed, so shouldn't they have a responsibility to give back in some way? Not so much financially.
Write to the producers of This Is Us and tell them they want to cast me on that show. I don't know. I need a job, right? Don't you need a job?
Always.
We people talk about, oh my God, I just got fired from my job. It's like, that's what actors go through all the time. We are unemployed after the job is over.
That's true. And with our current administration, they're going to cut all of our pensions. Anyway,
Follow me on Twitter, Frances_Fisher.
And also Instagram @FrancisFisher.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Frances.
Yeah.
Also, you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, on Amazon and
at
bookstores.
She can.
Check out our Facebook page. Also, the website is ileanaspodcast.com. If you want to know more about anything with the show, there's lots of great stuff there.
Yes, that's right. Come to my next party. Frances will be there singing.
Yes, exactly.
We'll be singing Irish songs. As we say, everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And sadly, it's the end of our show. But please come back, Frances Fisher.
Hell yes.
You're such an amazing actress.
Somebody come up with an idea for us to play sisters. Look at our eyes.
Oh, yes.
Look at those eyes.
Could I be Vivian Vance?
Yeah.
I'll put on 20 pounds. We could do Feud. Feud 2.
Oh, my God. Feud 2.
Exactly.
I want to see you as old Lucy. Old bitter Lucy. She was the greatest. I love Lucille Ball. Anyway, Frances Fisher, thank you.
Thank you, Frances.
Have a great day, everyone.
Everybody.
Thank you.
See you next time.
Peace and love.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.